More about Bonnie at her website, BonnieHendersonWrites.com. If you missed any portion of this show, you can find the entire show along with previous shows on my Beyond Your Front Door Organ playlist on SoundCloud.com. Bonnie, we are just about out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we wrap up?
Yeah, I like to tell people that the Oregon Trail is definitely not a wilderness experience, but it is an adventure. Selma, you'll meet interesting people. Every day is different. One day you'll be going past a bunch of fancy houses and hotels on the beach, and then you'll be in a portion of the coast where there's nobody, you don't see anybody for a day. I mean, and you have to be smart about it. So it is a great adventure. It's just very different from other trails, and it's so much fun.
Yeah, and that's really why your book is so helpful too, because there just really is a lot of things to think about, and it's rugged out here, and there are parts of this trail where you're going to be definitely on your own, and I think having your guidebook and hearing from somebody who's done the trail more than once is just really a great opportunity for people. Well, Bonnie, thank you so much for taking time to be here today. This has been really interesting, and I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations for airing Beyond Your Front Door. And thanks to Oregon-based Jumpin' the Rails for performing the theme song, Smith Chapel, used on this show. And thanks again to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
Rise them up, KBOO 90.7. You don't know it's your girl, Tasha T.
In San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, well, deep background and breaking news on the situation in Haiti. We call it the killing fields now, and we rebroadcast last night's powerful interview with noted Palestinian author, editor, and blogger Ramzi Baroud. And also, Miguel Gavila Molina is in farm worker country in Half Moon Bay. There's a lot going on down there. And we're going to share some of that with you today and tomorrow and throughout the week. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Coming up later on in this broadcast, Miguel Gavila Molina has been down in Half Moon Bay. We're going to be doing some special reporting from the ground there as they attempt to recover from the latest mass murder. There's a lot going on down there. And we've been really engaging with the farm workers of Half Moon Bay and across the coast for some time. So you want to stay tuned for that. We are, of course, always honored to have back with us our own senior producer, Kevin Pina, who knows as much about Haiti as anybody else in this world. Maybe Franz Jerome knows a little bit more. But together, they are quite a force in terms of real information of what's going on in the ground. And that's where we're going to begin. Kevin, we're going to have Franz in a moment, but it's good to have you with us. Why don't you give us sort of your version of an overview of where what we hear about Haiti is we stuff them on a plane and we force them back into what is becoming a sort of destabilized killing field.
now there's Biden's so-called new parole system, which is maybe a tip of the hat to acknowledging that Haiti is itself a prison of more than 12 million souls at this point, who are clamoring, many of who are clamoring to leave what has become a hell in the wake of failed U.S. foreign policy over three decades. We can trace this all the way back to the coup of 1991, through the coup of 2004, through the U.S. support of two successive corrupt regimes of the PHTK, the so-called skinhead party that was led by Michel Martelly, who owed his election to a direct intervention of then Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, and then his successor, Jovenel Moïse, who of course met his untimely end being assassinated by none other than Colombia mercenaries. Colombia mercenaries, of course, were one of his signature trademarks when he, his government itself, hired them to work with what was called the USGPN, which is the internal security of the president, to actually work to repress demonstrations that had been growing increasingly against his regime. These are two US-backed regimes. Currently, we have in power what's called PHTK Lite, which is Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who is now the successor of Jovenel Moïse after his assassination. And there is a clamor for him to resign. But anything that would allow Haitians to lead the process themselves, to call a national Congress, a national constituency, to be able to lead themselves out of this by creating an authentic government that would lead to new elections, that is being avoided by all costs by the U.S. government-led so-called core group of the international community, which of course includes France and Canada, those three nations who worked especially to overthrow the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004 that led to a 13-year U.N. military occupation where those three countries, the U.S., France, and Canada, had nearly total control over Haiti's institutions, only to lead it to this current death march today, which is being used as justification for another foreign intervention. So the first news today, breaking news, is that the U.S. Justice Department announced that four more key suspects in the murder of Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, has been arrested. That brings to total seven suspects. But let's not forget that one of the main suspects is Mario Antonio Palacios Palacio, who's a 43-year-old former Colombian soldier. He's charged with conspiracy to commit murder or kidnapping outside of the United States and with providing material support resulting in the death of Jovenel Moïse. But late April of last year, the U.S. Justice Department sealed the evidence against him, claiming that in the name of national security, it's called the CIPA, which is a special law that is used to seal evidence. It was used with Panama's former dictator when he was arrested after the U.S. invaded Panama, Manuel Noriega. It's now being used with Mario Antonio Palacios Palacios in a near nod by the U.S. government that the CIA was involved in this assassination. Also arrested in the first round of arrests was Jean-Joseph Joel, who was a former Haitian senator. He was also charged with conspiring to commit murder or kidnapping. He was known to have admitted ties, was working as an informant with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Finally, Rudolf Jarr, who was 49 and was arrested earlier last year, was working and known to be an agent of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency. Well, today they've added four more people to the list. James Solange, he's a South Florida maintenance worker who was suspected of the being one of the key figures in the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, as well as Joseph Vincent. And Joseph Vincent helped the Drug Enforcement Agency in 2017 to arrest none other than Guy Philippe, who is now being held in a U.S. federal prison in Atlanta, who led the 2004 coup against Aristide. He was arrested, and it was Vincent who brought him to the DEA and actually stood on the tarmac in turning him over. He worked for the Haitian police at that time, but is a known DEA agent, actually worked to turn Philippe over to the DEA when he was arrested in 2017. And then Christian Emmanuel Sanan, who's a failed businessman, whose involvement seems to be only to be a patsy in this, it's really unclear. Maybe Franz can talk more about his foundation and his work, which seemed to be non-existent. And then finally, another Colombian citizen, Germán Rivera García, whose we understand his records are also being petitioned to be sealed under the CIPA, which is, again, usually used in terrorist cases where the CIA is directly involved or has information or direct ties to people who are involved in activities that they do not want revealed. So that happened today. And right on point, almost as the Justice Department was announcing these four new arrests, adding to this list of seven, the government of Colombia, Jamaica Prime Minister Andrew Holness, announced that his country is now willing to deploy soldiers and police officers to Haiti as part of a multinational force that might be led by CARICOM. We have not had this kind of commitment made by a Caribbean country thus far, but the timing for me seems very suspect. Franz may have more to add to that.
All right, well, let's bring Franz Jerome in. That's, by the way, the voice of Kevin Pina. He's a senior producer here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. He specializes in reporting on Haiti. And also joining us is Franz Jerome, who knows even probably more than Kevin about Haiti. But Franz, what about what's been going on today, the latest arrests? You want to pick it up where Kevin left it off? And thanks for coming on.
Well, I'm happy to be with you, but you set me up in a tough spot because Kevin has already fleshed out the most important part of the information. So I will say that, you know, it is almost comical that as they were burying officers that had been killed by gang leaders, gangs, and apparently a report was issued where they said that those gangsters were empowered by three high members of the high command of the police in Haiti, and that's how they set up these four officers that were killed in Pétionville and in Liancourt. You know, we are talking about Solange Sanon and the Colombian and the other Haitian. I can get their names, but, you know, I don't think that these guys are important. I think they are distractions, and they are being used as distractions right now because there's so much going on the ground in Haiti. But most importantly, the police that these international groups are supposed to go and reinforce and empower to fight gangs. We hear that their commanding officers were involved in setting them up for the kill that happened 2 or 3 days ago. Yesterday, again, two more police officers died. You know, so now that was 6, 7 plus 4 gives you 11 plus 2 gives you 13. So within a week, 13 police officers were gunned down in Haiti, assassinated by gangsters. So people in Haiti are saying that it is too convenient. It is a setup. It is to justify the introduction of foreign troops in the context of the quote-unquote security situation of Haiti. So that's...
Franz, Franz, do you see...
Yeah, go ahead.
How do you... Go on. I'm sorry.
No, you can ask your question.
No, I'm wondering how you see, even in the context of a temporary endgame, is there a purpose? Is there a final game that you think the United States is playing at this time with Haiti? Where are we going, anywhere different here or back to occupation?
I don't know whether or not they are aiming at occupation, because how can you occupy a country that's already occupied? In 2003, they staged a coup. In 2004, in 2003, they prepared the coup that was staged in 2004. And in 2003, they were letting it be known by everybody that they were going to take over the country for at least 20 years. Now, 20 years are not up yet from 2004. So the country is already occupied. So to pretend that you're going to have an intervention in the context of an occupied Haiti that has been deteriorating under the tutelage of the international community, you know, it's a magician's game that they are playing with us, where they are trying to get us to confuse the situation that Haiti currently finding itself in living. The reality is that the international community under the UN responsibility to protect mandate, quote unquote, decided to invade Haiti. And Kevin can give you exactly how many elected, democratically elected officials they overthrew at that time. They took over. They restructured the police. They restructured the Justice Department. They did whatever they wanted to with the collaborators in Haiti. And then now, 19 years later, they are pretending that they have to step back in to correct the situation when they have been there all along. So now, I don't think it's an occupation that the United States wants. I think that most Haitians, let me put it this way, most Haitians believe that they want a change in the constitution, a change in the constitution that will allow foreign companies to own the subterranean wealth that's under Haiti. And that's all they worry about. They want to change the constitution because the current constitution prevents contract, prevents rights to exploitation of natural resources to be given to companies if it is not ratified by representatives of the people. And in the constitution of 1987, that's in for that's active right now, it says that all subterranean wealth belongs to the collectivity of Haitians. So no one Haitian can hold title to these resources. And that's what they want to change.
Kevin, you want to come in here, jump in with Franz?
Yeah, well Franz is absolutely correct. And I think it's the other point in this that I would add to what Franz just said is that under the U.S. puppet governments of the PHTK, the corrupt governments of Michel Martelly and Jovenel Moïse, there were sweetheart deals that were made without the ratification of the Haitian parliament that right now are allowing Canadian and U.S. companies to exploit Haiti's mineral wealth under the cloak of darkness. They are operating now, stealing that wealth illegally because it was never ratified by the parliament. And what they'd like to do is to grandfather in those illicit sweetheart deals that the previous U.S.-sponsored backed governments made with U.S. and Canadian companies and a couple of European companies operating as well to exploit, continue to steal Haiti's mineral wealth and not let it support the majority of the poor and to bring up the majority of the people. It's always what they've done with Haiti. You know, that's the real underlying pretext for this. So I agree with Franz 100%. The question is, you know, not if, but when they're going to build up, create the pretext for landing boots on the ground again. You know, it was 13 years and 5 months that they had near total control of that country of Haiti. And we can see what the results of it are. So we know that, in fact, if this is just about rushing towards elections again, where the U.S. and the international community, the U.S.-led international community, are the real kingmakers, and there's no change in the fundamental structure of the way that Haiti is governed, they're merely creating the same cycle, and it's not a question of if, but when we'll be back in this situation again.
What do you want to know from France, and what should we all know about sort of Biden in the short term, long term? Any read of what the plan is, or is it just sort of continue same old, including the absolutely vicious deportation plan that continues through Title 42?
Well, Franz, what's your view of Biden's policy? Is it different than what we've seen before? Do you expect anything different here?
Well, there is one thing that I should mention, that new parole program. You know, like, you know, you said on another program, Kevin, if it's a parole, that means that Haiti must be a jail if they are bringing Haitians over on a parole program. But that program is pros the Haitian resistance, because a lot of people You know, if you have a lion in danger in the forest, he is the strongest animal, so they say. But the lion will try to escape before he fights. If he has to fight, if he's cornered, he will fight, and he will probably win. Well, the Haitian population is being given an escape route, offered an escape route, which is not really an escape route, because there are 20 million of Haitians, and they are only offering them 180,000 over 2 years free pass. But becoming parolees in the United States is more more appealing to Haitians than living in the Haiti that was structured by Martelly and the international community, meaning the United States, Canada, and France mainly.
So, Franz, what effect does that actually have then on organizing a resistance in Haiti?
Well, I said it, you know, it froze everything. You know, people are,
fighting to get passports to leave, right?
Yes. And that froze everybody. So even if you're not willing to, if you're not ready to go and get a passport, but you have to think about it, but you realize that when you have to fight off, when you're in a fight or flight situation, fighting means that you don't doubt yourself. You don't hesitate. You have to move forward. The minute you stop to hesitate, you're done for. And you have gangs all around you willing to kill you, disappear you. You have the police willing to kill you, disappear you. Then, you know, militants, you know, activists that participate in organizing the people, the minute they slow down to think, well, do I get a passport? Do I get out of here? You know, it may cost them their lives.
And this is happening just as the puppet government of Ariel Henry
listening to Flashpoints on Pacific
a new
Radio.
High transit. Hello? Sorry. So this is happening.
Kevin
just
Pina,
the puppet,
senior producer, and Franz Jerome.
So this is Franz. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you,
Kevin.
So this is happening just as Ariel Henry's government, which we can call a puppet government of the United States, it really its livelihood depends, its existence depends on the U.S. government, right? But this is happening just as Ariel Henry is proposing a new structure to lead to new elections, U.S.-sponsored structure, yes?
Yes, and a new structure that people don't believe in. You know, all of the people who are not part of that structure believe that it's a joke. But at the same time, the international community has been uploading that new initiative very strongly, pretending that it can work. The trick that they use is that they gave it a title that it pretends that there is consensus. They call it the Consensus National pour la Transition, the National Consensus for Transition, as if there was a consensus. No, it's a title that includes the word consensus, because they cannot get a consensus because they have been rejected by the people throughout. Now, even the police is rejecting them. Daily since last week, there has been demonstrations throughout the country of police officers rejecting Ariel Henry's government and rejecting the commanders of the police that they say is plotting against them instead of helping them acquire the means to fight the gangs. Hello?
I'm right with you. Kevin, are you there?
Oh,
yeah, I'm here.
I just sort of want to hit this with a sledgehammer. The Biden administration is still using, they call it Trump policy, but the hammer, the sledgehammer is really coming down on lots of people, and the Haitians are continuing to be really destroyed by this policy because it's really, 42 is simply an excuse to end asylum, and the Haitians are among the most impacted. It's sort of like they're hammered out of their country, and then they're running into an anvil and smashed here and sent back, and it's like a slingshot operation, and it's really not on the radar, but it's an international human rights nightmare and violation. And I, you know, is anybody considering this in the context of international human rights violations? Where's Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch? What is the deal?
Well, it's a joke, really, because this so-called parole program kind of does not allow Haitians to demand asylum for political reasons, for persecution, for human rights abuses. Instead, it's allowing this sort of safety valve whose intention is not to help Haitians really to get to the United States. Its intention is to affect the political reality in Haiti. As Franz said, this is creating tremendous problems for the resistance in Haiti, right? This is creating turmoil among families. Franz, I want you to say it, but I remember something so important you said about how this is creating tension between the diaspora and their families in Haiti, who are clamoring for Biden's new parole program to leave Haiti's jails, what the jail that Haiti has become as a result of U.S. foreign policy. But that tension, can you describe that? I thought you said that really eloquently.
Well, one thing that many Haitians living in Haiti, and not only people in the community, there was a priest that went that very Sunday after the parole program was announced, and he was saying this is a tool to divide people, and now people in Haiti, everybody in Haiti is going to hate people in the United States because they are going to think that they are the ones preventing them from coming into the United States, and that's
because they require reason. Response, that's why right?
Yes. They don't want to sponsor them. But that's what I was calling the magical trick that they are using, because, you know, it's an illusion that they created that people can escape that hell that was created in Haiti. 180 maximum, in an overpopulation of 12 million people. I think that it's very, very cruel to put people in a situation where a lot of brothers will hate their brothers or sisters in the United States because they will think that they are the ones keeping them, condemning them to stay in Haiti.
Right. They've taken what was asylum for persecution and human rights abuses, and have now transferred the responsibility for Haitians coming to the United States to their family, their loved ones, and their friends, who must sponsor them in order to participate in Biden's program. Is that right?
But also, if they say that all people need is a sponsor, when they capture them in high sea, why don't they bring them into the United States and see if people want to sponsor them? Why do they ship them back in Haiti? So you know, it's clear what the objective is. The objective is not to facilitate the protection of anybody, but to send a signal, a message, a loud message that you're not to come until we tell you to come.
Listen, I got to jump in here. Both of you have really provided an important discussion. It's just it's a mind blower how Haiti is allowed, how this is allowed to go on. It escapes the radar. The reporting is pathetic. And that's why the Flashpoints community really appreciates the work of you, Kevin, and of course you, Franz. Jerome, thanks for coming on today. Obviously, we're going to keep on keeping on this story. Both of you, please stay safe. I have to tell people you're listening to Pacifica Radio. That's the People's Radio Network, KPFA in the Bay Area. We are happy to be broadcasting to you every weekday from 5 to 6. We'll take a short break. Then we'll be right back with Miguel Gabriel Molina. He is in Half Moon Bay, and they are still trying to overcome the massive tragedy that befell that community in one of the latest mass shootings. Stay with us. listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I know that you know what happened in Half Moon Bay. There was one more of these mass shootings. The community is suffering, trying to recover. Miguel Gavilan Molina, our senior producer, is down there. We're going to be doing some extensive reporting on how this is impacting in a very special and difficult way for the farm worker community, which was in struggle before this latest tragedy. And Flashpoints has always been hooked in with the farm worker communities in Half Moon Bay and also, you know, all over the state. That's what we do in terms of our reporting because of Miguel being a former child farm worker and having a deep, close relationship with the United Farm Workers. So we're hooked in. Miguel, we're going to have a lot more on this tomorrow, but why don't you just give us a sense of the mood down there and what's going on, what you've been seeing.
Well, Dennis, when I first got down here, it was, you know, beautiful, beautiful day, warm, but, you know, coolness, a crisp coolness in the air, no clouds, and everything. Of course, the abundant rain we had a couple of weeks ago turned everything lush and green, beautiful. But once I arrived and got myself situated, I went to the Alas Center. And that's a cultural center where the vice mayor, Joaquin Jimenez, works out of. I parked there and I took a walk around town and was able to spend about an hour with him, you know, talking and kicking it. It was pretty special. And then I went off my own and just started looking and, you know, talking to some people. And, you know, besides the beautiful, it was just an unbelievable, beautiful, gorgeous day. There was a cloud of grief over the area. And particularly when I spoke to some brown folks, you know, some Latinos of the community, there was this, Dennis, I have to say, people are in, you know, shell shock. They have not gotten over it. Yeah. And, you know, but then I'm looking at the other community and the tourists, you know, the tourists are there smiling, taking selfies, you know, and because it's a tourist town. And I'm walking and looking at the shops, the boutiques. It's all, you know, for the wealthy. You know, it's not for poor working class folks. And, you know, I'm looking at the surfers, you know, because it's also a surfer community. You know, surfers come from all over the world to, you know, to Half Moon Bay in that area. Right. From there all the way down to Big Sur, because it's some of the best surfing, you know, on earth. And smiling, laughing, having fun. But then when I look at the brown community, there wasn't, I didn't see laughing, cheering. People are somber. And, I also spent a little time talking to the director of the Alas Center there. And Alas means wings to dream. The center is there to help people achieve their dreams. And Alas, which means wings, gives wings to the dreams of Latino children, families, and farm workers in this town. So that area, Dennis, was busy. I mean, unbelievable. The whole time, particularly in the morning and in the early afternoon, I just kept seeing people coming and going, both bringing food, bringing blankets, bringing shoes, because it gets cold. And, you know, people are bringing, you know, goods, you know, to the place, donations in form of food and clothing and blankets. And it was also people coming to pick up food, family after family. And you know, the center there, I believe, you know, gives out up to, you know, 30,000 bags of food, you know, in a year's time. And when I was there, you know, I'm here. I mean, I'm seeing there, you know, just the food going out and food coming. And I'm saying, with so much wealth and so much bounty here, there's a lot of hunger, you know, and the people coming in, you know, to get food and to get donations. I saw, you know, mostly Latino and, you know, Asian folks coming in, you know, to get food, to get blankets, to get clothes. You know, a sense of community and the spirit of coming together. But I'll tell you, Dennis, you know, what happened here, you know, the grief is going to hang over a long time. These wounds are going to take a long time to heal because, you know, the problems that are here that contribute to people, you know, losing it or breaking and then going out and committing these monstrous, you know, crimes against humanity. You know, people are desperate. People are broken. People are hungry. People are cold. I was able to go out at the mushroom farm where the incident happened. And, you know, it's under investigation. It's, you know, parts of it are roped off and so forth. But I was able to see, you know, with my press credentials and stuff, I was able to see it isn't housing, Dennis. It's metal boxes. You know, and you know, it's a mushroom farm providing the incredible mushrooms, you know, that we all have, you know, and especially the cuisine, the chefs, the fancy food and all of that, you know. Well, a lot of that, you know, prime, you know, grade AAA mushroom, you know, comes from this area. And you also have garlic and you also have artichoke. So, you know, I'm seeing all this food, all this wealth and all, you know, and I'm walking up and down the streets, Main Street particularly. And, you know, you see all these restaurants, these fancy restaurants, world-class chefs. And I look, you know, I walked in a couple of them and I'm looking at the labor force. Well, you know, in the kitchens, servers, waitresses and so forth, waiters, mostly brown. So I'm saying the food is comes from the fields, comes from the farms and ranches, and then it's processed, you know, by brown folks in the kitchens and then served by brown folks. And I'm going, all of this wealth, all of this money, and people are still hungry, Dennis. You know, I saw
families. It's unbelievable. You know, listen, Miguel, you know, obviously you're down there for some deep reporting. We've got some inside connections there. So we're going to learn a lot more about how this community is not getting what some of the other communities that suffer this kind of mass attack. So we know that you're going to be down there with some very special people, and we're going to devote most of tomorrow to this community, what their struggle is and what their needs are. So Miguel, we thank you for showing up there. We know that Flashpoints has had a long connection with this community, and
yes,
as I say and as you are demonstrating, we're there and we're going to report this all the way through, and we're going to sort of hold the governor accountable to attend to this community the way other communities are attended to, and get the attention and the care they need. Be safe, Miguel. Yes. We will talk to you and many guests tomorrow. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Thanks, Miguel. Really. We're going to replay from last night's broadcast a very powerful interview with Ramzi Berard on the ongoing ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Listen to this. This is sort of what the press looks like. Just a perfect example. This is the BBC. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has called for Israel and the Palestinians to take urgent steps to restore calm and amid escalating violence. Speaking in Jerusalem, Blinken reiterated his support for a two-state solution as the best way to bring security to the two sides. Israel's new government opposes the creation of a Palestinian state. Joining us to talk about it, and we are so glad to have him, is Ramzi Berard. He is an internationally syndicated columnist, a media consultant, and author, founder, editor of the Palestine Chronicle, and the managing editor of the London-based Middle East Eye. He is the author of, among other things, Searching Jenin, the Second Palestinian Intifada, and My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, Gaza's Untold Story. He also co-authored with Alain Pompei, Our Vision for Liberation, Engaged Palestinian leaders and intellectuals speak out. Well, Ramsey, welcome back to Flashpoints. It is good to have you with us. You know, I read a little bit from the BBC, but it's sort of like every story you're going to read about what's going on, you know, sympathy for the Israelis, urging calm on both sides. Do you want to sort of talk a little bit about how you see the situation now and the idea of urging calm on both sides? When do you suppose the violence started for you?
It seems to be kind of the same question, not on your part, you know, from you personally, but the same question that we Palestinians are confronted with all the time is the fact that the story becomes a story in mainstream media, BBC and everyone else, when Palestinians retaliate. But when the Palestinians are the victims, there is no story. It's complete calm, complete quiet. And that quiet is only shattered when a Palestinian takes a gun or a knife or a stone or a Molotov cocktail and attacks Israeli settlers or Israeli soldiers. But the fact that the act of military occupation itself, which has been around since 1967 until this day, and the act of colonization of Palestine, which began 75 years ago. I mean, these are all violent acts, and I don't mean violence from an intellectual point of view, as in apartheid and military occupation is in itself a violent act. I mean that on a daily basis, military occupation, apartheid, colonialism brings about numerous acts of violence, from the violence of Israeli soldiers, the daily killing of Palestinians, to the violence of the destruction of Palestinian homes, Palestinian orchards, and ancient olive trees, to preventing Palestinians to leave or return or go to their universities or live in nominally normal lives. But nobody talks about it, and it's just really getting to be so frustrating that makes you wonder why is Palestine an occupied country being seen as an aggressor in the longest running military occupation in the world, while on the other hand, in the case of Ukraine, for example, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it hasn't been around officially for a year yet it is seen to be one of the most gruesome attacks of modern civilization. Why the double standards? So not only the what's going on in Palestine right now is a retaliation to numerous acts of violence carried out by Israel for a long, long time, but since January 1st until this day, over 30, actually the number is from 2-3 days ago, so about 33 Palestinians were killed by Israel. Last year alone, the United Nations said that 2022 has been the most violent year in Palestine since 2005. What happened in 2005? That was the end of the second Palestinian uprising. Since then until today, last year was the largest number of dead Palestinians in Jenin, in Jerusalem, in Qalqilya, in Tulkarem, more than any other time. And many of them are children, many of them are civilians. So the question is, why didn't Mr. Blinken find it so urgent to run to Palestine and to Israel and to talk to the leaders about the need for calm? Why didn't Mr. Biden, who yesterday referred to the Palestinian attack in occupied East Jerusalem that killed seven Israeli Jewish settlers, he referred to this as an attack on civilization, an attack on civilization. But what happened prior to that, a couple of days prior to that, 10 people were killed in Jenin, 10 people, including an old lady who was killed sitting in her living room. Why wasn't that an attack on civilization? Why wasn't this, or rather the civilized world, just in case I'm quoted, an attack on the civilized world. Why was that completely omitted from Mr. Biden's political agenda? When the occupier kills occupied people that they are supposed to protect under international law, it's nothing. It's not a problem at all. It's business as usual. When Palestinians, God forbid, retaliate in any way, that is an affront to our civilization. Why is that? Why the double standards? So Mr. Blinken's visit to Palestine. Go ahead.
No, please. Just go right ahead. I mean, it's so important for you to unpack the story and put it in the context of some kind of reality, because you've got somebody talking about, when I hear two-state solution, what I hear is two-state delusion and as a fantasy that's used to every time the United States wants to sort of suppress the Palestinians and undermine their resistance.
That's precisely what it is, Dennis. But the fact is, I feel like we are all kind of, I don't know, like that movie, the Matrix, where the red pill and the yellow and the blue pill. I can't remember which one puts you in the state of illusion. But I feel like we've all have taken, swallowed this pill of the American mainstream media and American officials, from CNN to Fox News. I mean, the weird thing about all of this is that there is massive polarization in the United States right now. They seem to disagree on everything, from race to war, to police violence and brutality, to immigration, to women rights, to identity politics, to everything, except of one single story that they all have in common. And it's been the same story that American mainstream media has in common throughout the years. And that is Israel good, Palestinians are bad. But you say, but why are Palestinians so bad? I mean, after all, they are occupied people. I mean, what do you expect? What the Ukrainians are doing, they are blowing up bridges, they are doing everything that the Palestinians haven't actually done. They haven't done a tiny percentage of what Ukraine is doing to fight back. Yet somehow, anything that the Palestinians do is bad. Not just violence, not just resistance, but even boycotting. I mean, imagine the peaceful act of boycotting, saying, do not buy products that comes from Israeli settlements or products that benefits the Israeli army in any way, because the money and the funds go to buy bullets and guns and kill Palestinians. That in itself is supposed to be an anti-Semitic act. Basically, we have no breathing room whatsoever. We can't get it right in any possible way. And everyone seems to agree. And only when Israelis get killed, Blinken goes, drops everything, and he goes running from Egypt to Israel to Palestine to Jordan, trying to ensure that Israel remains safe. No matter what Israel does, nobody cares. We are yelling, we're screaming, we're saying to the world, please pay attention to what's happening here. Our people are dying. Our people are living in complete and utter isolation. We haven't achieved anything of our rights, and apartheid is getting worse and worse by the day. And we don't even get a mention. We don't even get an acknowledgement of our struggle and of our suffering. But if a Palestinian fights back, everybody has to line up in order for them to condemn that terrorist vile act that is an affront to modern civilization.
And now there's a situation where you literally have a bunch of, to put it mildly, accused criminals who are now running the government. They all have records in the leadership, and they have sworn to really make the life of a Palestinian even more miserable than it is. There's we hear time and again. What goes through your mind when you hear the Israelis say they have no partners to make peace with on the Palestinian side? You want to deconstruct that little phrase?
So So there's a group of people, the optimists amongst us, whether in the Palestinian, within the Palestinian community itself, or within the pro-Palestine camp, that believes that there is an iota of conscience, there is an iota of common sense, that once Israel crosses certain imaginary lines, the world is going to wake up. Americans are going to say, no, we are not going to support Israel under these conditions. Not when you have someone like Ben-Gvir, a terrorist, or Ariel Dari, a convicted criminal, or Bezalel Smotrich, another criminal terrorist and a person who made a career just inciting for violence. No, when these people are ministers in a government, it's a fascist government, and we can't cover Israel, Israeli crimes anymore. We can't make the argument, well, you know what, this is just Israel's the greatest democracy in the Middle East, and Israel, you know, is right under any circumstance, because this is beyond our ability to bear. But somehow, when I argued this repeatedly in my articles, I said, just wait for it. Those optimists, just wait for it. Before you know it, Ben-Gvir is going to become an ally. And all of these criminal characters that the U.S. has warned against joining the Netanyahu government will become part and parcel of whatever American designs in Palestine, Israel, and the Middle East. And that is precisely what's happening right now. Israel is the victim. It has nothing to do with the fact that Tamar Ben-Gvir raided Al-Aqsa Mosque as his first act as a minister of national security. He went to provoke a religious war, and nothing happened. And we have forgotten about it completely. We have forgotten about all the anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian, and anti-Muslim and Christian incitements by Ben-Gvir and his ilk, as if nothing that is taking place in Palestine is a response to something that existed prior. As if the Palestinian retaliation is the beginning of all events, is the beginning of the timeline of violence, and everything else is forgotten. The killing of all the Palestinians, the constant raid on Jenin, the constant attacks on Nablus, the constant attacks on the Balata refugee camp, the ongoing siege on the the Shu'afat refugee camp, the attacks on Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. None of this matters. None of this is needed for the context. The context is the Palestinians have done something bad and they need to be punished for it. And they keep telling us about the Israeli retaliation. Israel is carrying out tougher measures against the Palestinians as a result of the attack in Jerusalem. The tougher measures, not destroying the homes of people who were not in any way involved. What did the families have to do with this? What did the neighbors of the attacker have to do with this? Why are you destroying their homes? The father was taken by the Israeli soldiers. They broke his arm. They beat him up. They arrested many members of that. What democratic country does this? What state in this civilized world, in which Biden keeps referring to, accepts this kind of gangster-like criminal behavior? But again, you're not supposed to talk about it. You're just supposed to stand and condemn and refuse to condone such terrorism. And by the way, the term terrorism only applies to Palestinians. No matter what Israel does, no matter what the Israelis do, only Palestinians are terrorists. There are never resistance fighters. There are never peaceful protesters. There are never any category that we can do business with, or we can accept, or we can deal with in any possible way. Only Palestinians are capable of being terrorists. And Israelis, the likes of Ben-Gvir, are always in a state of self-defense, despite the fact that Israel is a military occupier.
It's, of course, everybody knows it's a nuclear renegade, too. But I have a question. I don't mean it to be rhetorical, but how long does it take an F-17A fighter jet that Israel gets from the United States? How long does it take to fly over the occupied, locked down Gaza Strip with what, over how many million people? Most densely populated
over 2 million people
place
at this
in the
point.
World. How many drones? And how many jets? And how long does it take to provide a bomb for every living Palestinian? And they could do it in a second, but they don't go that far, do they, when they do what they call mowing the lawn?
That's right, because Gaza right now, if you know anybody who's been to Gaza in recent times, it really is like a high security prison. There is no escape. You are trapped. Electric fences, walls, everywhere. Last time I was in Gaza, I arrived at night. I opened the window of my hotel, and it was right on the beach. And what I saw in front of me, this very strange sight of all this, like almost like the Israeli Navy lining up at the horizon, blocking any movement or an out of Gaza via sea. And all of these Palestinian fishermen are trapped within 3 kilometer, you know, area. Or 3 nautical miles, rather, and all fighting for the small amount of fish that is there. And the drones are buzzing everywhere. We're for a reason or no reason. It's a psychological warfare. We call them in Arabic the tannana, because it kind of has this like this strange sounds that's almost like deafening. You don't get used to it. That's the strange thing. So you see the drones on top of you, filming, taking pictures constantly. And you see the soldiers on the other side of the fence with their guns and that watchtowers. And towards the sea, you see the Navy. They're lining up ready to shoot any fisherman who would dare go beyond the 3 nautical miles. And all of this is happening in a space that is supposed to be calm. This is not an act of violence. This is an everyday reality. In fact, Israel tells you, we have already evacuated Gaza. Gaza is not—it's not our responsibility. In fact, they already declared Gaza a hostile territory. Okay, so if you have evacuated Gaza, why don't you allow Gazans to come and leave? Why are they blocked from all directions? The vast majority of people in Gaza are minors under the age of 17. And the vast majority of all Gazans never stepped out of Gaza. We are talking about a space that is 181 square miles. It's a very tiny stretch of land in which something like 2.1 million lives. And even the little agricultural land that allowed Gaza to exist and practice some kind of self-sufficiency in terms of food, that has been destroyed by Israel. All of this land has been destroyed because most of this land is near the Israeli defense that Israel imposed on Gaza. And nobody dares to get there. Quite often, farmers get shot when they are trying to reach their crops or their orchards. So many people don't dare to even venture out there. And Israel wants us to believe that this is a state of normalcy now. If a Palestinian under these circumstances, you know, dared carry a gun, throw a rock, do anything of that nature, that's an act of violence, and that Palestinian deserves to be executed on the spot. And American media would report on that as an infringement on Israeli security by the Palestinians. But that reality, this very strange Kafkian reality imposed by Israel on the Palestinians for decades, it is supposed to be a state, a normal state of affairs. And Palestinians are not even allowed to complain about it. Because the mere complaint or criticism or attempting to get the Security Council or the United or the General Assembly to condemn Israel in any way is an act of anti-Semitism. So what do you do? You are trapped. You can't even talk. You can't even be on mainstream media. And if you are, you are going to be shouted out and insulted as if you are a common criminal. I made it to, you know, strangely a few days ago to some mainstream outlet. And I didn't even answer the first question before the news anchor asked me. He said, "Do you condone what the Palestinians are doing to the Israelis?" I said, "Sir, I am not a politician. I am a historian and I'm a journalist. I'm going to provide you with context." He said, "Sir, do you condone what the Palestinians are doing?" How do you even deal with that sort of thinking? And these are win once in a blue moon, there's a tiny little space for us Palestinians to even express our viewpoint about these issues.
Wow. Well, listen, I promised I wasn't going to take up too much of your time, Ramsey, but we really appreciate you taking out the time. I want to again tell people that you are an internationally syndicated columnist, a media consultant, author, founder, editor of the Palestine Chronicle, and the managing editor of the London-based Middle East Eye. You are the author of Searching Janine, the Second Palestinian Intifada, and My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, Gaza's Untold Story, and you've written the extraordinary work with Alon Pape, Our Vision for Liberation, Engaged Palestinian Leaders and Intellectuals Speak Out. Listen, we really do appreciate the time, and we are sorry that this situation is perpetrated year after year, and Blinken is there again. Blinken is a good name because he I guess he knows when to do the blinking and when to do the looking. But we thank you for taking the time out, sir. Hope you'll
thank
be
you
safe.
Very much, Dennis, and it's always great to talk to you, and keep up the good work.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m. Next up is The Bike Show.